either paint it or draw it or write it down, right? And then pass it on to somebody. They read what you're saying, and then they re-experience, and that's the only connection you have with that man. So you can't rewrite, because to rewrite is to deceive and lie, and you betray your own thoughts. To rethink the flow and the rhythm and the tumbling out of the words is a betrayal. It's a sin, Martin.
I don't accept your Catholic interpretation of my compulsive necessity to rewrite every single word at least 100 times. Guilt is the key, not sin. Guilt re not writing the best that I can. Guilt re not considering everything from every possible angle. Balancing everything.
Well, how about guilt re-censoring your best thoughts, your most honest, primitive, real thoughts? Because that's what your laborious rewriting amounts to.
Is rewriting really censorship, Bill? Because I'm completely fucked if it is.
Exterminate all rational thought. That is the conclusion I have come to.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Infrequent Podcast, the Interzone Asylum Podcast. There's the creator and sole recurring host, Jake, joined by another new guest this time, my friend and former film studies buddy, Koyuki. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Koyuki, and I used to be classmates with Jake in the film studies program. And yeah, thank you for having me here today. So today, we're going to plan to discuss about the famous modern horror director, James Wan, and his wonderful movies, Saw, the first of Saw from 2003, and the very first movie of Conjuring in 2013.
Yeah, I kind of figured it would be interesting to see because both of these, well, I asked Koyuki because I know she's a fan of James Wan and The Conjuring, but also because it's interesting to see how this filmmaker in two decades was able to usher in some of those popular horror franchises. Like, I probably couldn't think of a horror franchise in the 2000s that was more prevalent in people's minds than Saw, even as they kept getting degraded worse and worse from critics and such. But, and The Conjuring, again, it spawned its own little mini horror universe, right? Even divorced from the strict sequels in itself. Just to see what maybe struck a chord, and maybe we'll talk about the films themselves and maybe look at like why exactly they struck that such a chord with a popular audience.
Yeah, and even like the style of the evolution for like over what, a decades apart, it's really interesting to see like how you can see a little change and the difference from one to the other every single year. And he's super active, you know, in directing and producing, especially in the horror field.
Yeah, he's definitely a real name. I mean, I guess aside from horror, what else? Yeah, he directed Furious 7 and Aquaman, which aren't horror films.
He decides to, you know, head towards the Steven Spielberg kind of a direction, you know? But yeah, horror is really his specialty, and it's something that all of us will never forget, and it's something that we respect. Just to give a bit of background of the director himself, James Wan, he was born on February 26, 1977, and he is a Malaysian-Australian film director, and he first started to gain, you know, his debut and his visibility in 2003 when he collaborated with his longtime, you know, writing partner, Leigh Whannell, over the short film of Saw in 2003. And that's where he captured the attention of many big name directors, film directors, and he got his first directing film for Saw in 2004, the very first full movie, right?
Yep.
And one thing that's interesting about James Wan is that James Wan came up with the six rules of making, you know, horror films successful with Leigh Whannell, which is his longtime partner, as I mentioned. The first one is horror doesn't have to be so expensive because independent filmmakers have some serious constraints, whether it's about creativity or financial wise. The second rule is to turn classic horror onto its head, which means that you don't have to sacrifice creativity to be able to have your film visible to your audiences. The third one is to develop a great set pieces. It doesn't have to be a lot of props. You don't need a lot of props to have to capture the attention of the audience. It can be, for instance, you know, a single big picture or a creepy doll or et cetera, et cetera. A small artifact, just one artifact, a minimalist artifact, is what is important. It's what makes the audience think and start to feel this fear and this goosebumps. And the fourth rule is undermining the audience. So you have to be aware of how people see your work, but more on how you see your own work. That's how he would see it. What that means is that if you look at it into Conjuring and Saw later on, which what we will both be talking about, is that he focuses not just on the visuals, but the importance of sound as well, because it evokes the emotions. He knows very well over the importance of sound, which go back in history, over how sound makes a big difference with the cinematic experiences for the audiences over time. And the last one is to be sincere and embrace the primal human fears, especially the classical ones, such as darkness, such as, you know, the ancient stuff, like supernatural stuff, and even not just biological, but even, you know, he goes back into history and he tries to keep these classical conventions. So those are the important things that we look at, especially when it comes to James Wan. So this can be applied in the movie Saw for 2003.
Yeah, I think all those things are very clear in his work. He's very, yeah, he makes the most out of, like, yeah, the shadows and the editing in his work, as well as just simple visual props that still stick in the viewer's mind long after. And he's, especially with The Conjuring, he's definitely interested in not really pushing things forward in a sense, but he is interested in sort of honoring the classical conventions of the horror genre in a sense. And you could argue a sort of conservative way, but like to him, that's a form of sincerity in a sense, because you are recognizing it as a constructed film genre in a sense, and not something that's necessarily realistic. Like, he very much believes in horror as almost like a thrill ride versus something that's intensely personal, I think. And I think that's part of what has made his work very accessible to the mainstream.
Yeah, and especially what makes it interesting, what makes me super drawn about the director himself, is that he has a background of a Western and Eastern culture, right? So he brings these conventions of Eastern horror films into Hollywood and whatsoever. I feel like, you know, he's taking the best of both worlds, and that's why, you know, it's reuniting everyone around the world, especially, you know, the East and the West, Asia, Europe, and North America, Africa, South Africa, everywhere, you know, people of color. It brings this diversity, not just in the race, but also in the creative vision and all that. So I thought that it's really interesting, especially when we look into his works, and including, you know, Saw and Conjuring, to see how the other cultures become involved with the work whatsoever, whether it's the actors on set or the post-productions and so forth.
Yeah, I think so. With that, we can just get into the films proper. We can talk about his breakthrough, the 2004, now, I guess you can call it now, horror classic, Saw from 2004. And you can just give like a, I'll just give a plot summary. So yeah, a doctor named Dr. Lawrence Gordon and a struggling photographer, Adam, and find themselves chained in a abandoned rusty bathroom with a corpse in the middle of the room. And they find that eventually they realize that they are in the game of the Jigsaw Killer, a infamous serial killer, though they claim in the film that he doesn't actually murder anybody, which I can question that. But anyway, yeah, whose motivation in killing, actually putting these people in these symbolic or literal games in which they must atone for their sins in order to activate their survival instinct and learn to appreciate life actually in an extremely brutal way. And so over the course of the film, we get backstory on the two characters, where we find that why they ended up there. We know Dr. Gordon was cheating on his wife with one of his interns, and then Adam himself was being paid to spy on people like Dr. Gordon himself, well, by a cop Tapp, who is obsessed with Jigsaw and with Dr. Gordon, who's played by Danny Glover in the film. And eventually they discover that an intern at Gordon's hospital, Zepp, who's played by Michael Emerson, who was an antagonist in the show Lost, he is holding Dr. Gordon's wife and daughter hostage, and they believe he himself is the one responsible for this whole game. But eventually, after Dr. Gordon saws his own leg off to escape from the chains, Zepp shows up and they're able to subdue him. But then they realize Zepp was only another victim, and then they realize that the real Jigsaw killer was right in front of them the whole time, playing dead in the middle of the room, and he was John Kramer, Dr. Gordon's cancer patient, who we only saw in full in one scene before, and he leaves Adam in the room to die. That's the basic plot gist of Saw. We can get into more specifics. So what did you think of the film overall, and perhaps why do you think it struck a chord with audiences?
It's been such a long time since I haven't seen it, but yesterday, you know, a few days ago, I saw it, and actually, when I looked at it many times, it became quite clear to me. I expected it to be way more, you know, way more bloody and gory than I thought, but it was more like a psychological, you know, suspense. You know, there was a lot of suspense. You know, James Wan has been keeping us on the hook to just watch every single detail, you know, and even the puzzles that Jigsaw leaves to Adam and Dr. Lawrence, especially like the X, right, to find the X in the dark, or even, you know, like follow your heart, the heart on the toilet.
Yeah, it's more of a murder mystery than like a torture porn, which is what the series became known for in its sequels. And I should say, I've seen Saw 2 and 3. I stopped after 3 because I thought 3 was just really bad. I just had no interest in continuing. So, like, it might be hard because we know a bit about Jigsaw, the Jigsaw killer's, like, philosophy and motivations in this film, though the sequels do expand more on his life and stuff, so it might be hard not to maybe reference the other movies when we talk about Jigsaw himself. But the first film does give us fairly succinct ideas of why he's doing what he's doing, even if we don't know his entire backstory yet.
Yeah, and you could see a lot of, you know, some similarities with the opening of Saw to Insidious. There was a lot of, you know, dark blue color and the text and all that. The text fades out as if there's a ghost coming out. So if you see, you know, the very first Insidious, you know, in your own time, you could see that the similarities with the opening there. It just kind of repeats itself in its sense. So I kind of feel like in the very beginning, James Wan's way of hooking the audience is to show one of the creepy, you know, creepy parts, whether it's an artifact. But in this situation, it's in a creepy room, in a really crappy room, especially, you know, in a crappy room, there's a dead body laying on the ground and is holding the tape recorder. And, you know, you have to find yourself a way out when there's almost nothing to, you know, hold on to, when you're especially chained to the other ends of the, you know, room.
Yeah, that opening, we basically see Adam is asleep in the bathtub, and we see like a glowing object, which we only see briefly, but it gets sucked down the drain, and we kind of forget about it the rest of the movie. And at the end, we realize that was the key to his chain the whole time, and it got sucked down. But I might have something to point out there is, how is he alive underwater? How long was he underwater for? And also, why would Jigsaw place give him like something like that? Did he know it was going to flush down the drain? What if it didn't? Like, then, okay, he would just had a really easy escape the whole time. It almost feels like Jigsaw got lucky with that, but at the same time, it's like, okay, you kind of just doomed the guy.
Yeah, but even when you think about it, as you mentioned, you know, like how you would see more as psychological torture plot, we both agree that. But then a lot of people would mention that it's, you know, a torture kind of porn. You know how during the movie, Adam at some point discovered that the behind the mirror, there's the camera surveillance thing. There's this form of voyeurism there. So probably like that's like one of the reasons why some people would perceive, you know, the Saw as a, you know, as a torture pornographic way.
Well, I think just to give into a cultural context, I think like, you know, this is made post 9/11, right? And sort of beheading videos of these terrorist organizations and snuff films were being proliferated throughout the internet. And there's definitely an aspect of technology like that in Saw, like you mentioned, that voyeurism, but also like the videotapes that Jigsaw leaves, as well as the audio tapes, is this crude lo-fi technology he's using to for these games that he's playing. But also I kind of was thinking about, in a more moral sense, you know, after 9/11, you saw a lot of rise in morality, or like a moral righteousness amongst, you know, a lot of like the American politicians and the American military after that. But yet these people partook in like waterboarding and like just really sadistic torture of these people they deemed enemies, and for the sake of moral righteousness. And Jigsaw himself has this morally righteous view of what he's doing, that he is helping people reach their potential and understand and appreciate life more, but he's doing it through quite brutal and sadistic means, even though he probably doesn't think of himself as a sadist, just like the way these American politicians and the military themselves wouldn't think of themselves as that. So it's maybe fading into the zeitgeist of that time in the political spectrum.
And also, since you've seen the other Saw franchises and all that, I'm just kind of wondering, did they emphasize more on the doll in the later films? Because I know, like in the first one, there wasn't much emphasis on the doll itself. It's more like towards the halfway end. That's yeah, what I kind of noticed on that.
Yeah, you only see the doll in the flashback of woman Amanda, who also appears in the sequels, how she breaks out of the reverse bear trap, right? But yeah, they put more emphasis on the doll in the other ones. Then they give the doll a backstory. It was actually it was a doll that Jigsaw or John Kramer was designing for his unborn child.
It's very similar to in Conjuring, you know, the very opening scene. It's, you know, at the doll Annabelle. So I just see, you know, like the parallels there. That's why I was asking about that.
I would kind of wonder like what the significance, even ignoring the sequels, when we know it has a literal meaning for John Kramer or Jigsaw. But in this first film, you know, because it's like a childlike thing, and, you know, he wheels it out to Amanda after, you know, she's escaped. So is it like rebirth almost? Is that what the doll symbolizes kind of?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That question can also be applied for, you know, Conjuring, especially in the very, you know, opening scene where you see the doll's face, you know, the doll Annabelle's face. So that's one question that the audience can consider about.
Yeah, so like I guess we need to return to like the bathroom. Yeah, when they both wake up, they don't know who each other are, though we later learn that Adam does know who Dr. Gordon is. But at the moment, they're just really confused. They find, you know, tape recordings where you know, Jigsaw calls Adam just pathetic, and that Dr. Gordon is going to be the one that has to kill Adam, or else his family is going to be killed. Yeah, I guess the shackles, you know, it's like, you know, because Gordon himself feels shackled by his own life, even though he claims to love his wife and daughter, he's cheating on his wife, right? So it's like the shackles are like him feeling trapped, but then Adam is also trapped because he's, you know, a struggling photographer who has to take these shitty jobs of spying on people. So it's kind of like they have to break free of where they've trapped themselves. So I guess you can say that's the symbolic thing there. But I feel like Adam is almost more just a pawn for Dr. Gordon's story, because in the script, which I looked at before, it says that Adam was suicidal and suffering from depression and stuff. And that's why Jigsaw also chose him, because he saw people like who don't appreciate their life as pathetic. And they took those out of the movie. And so it kind of feels like Adam gets a little shortchanged in terms of character. He feels a little more just a pawn for Dr. Gordon.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about Saw is there wasn't much, a lot of settings used, you know, it was mostly based on, you know, a few flashbacks, you know, one in the hospital, one in the inspector's room, one in Dr. Lawrence's house, and one mostly, you know, in the crap hole room, you know?
Yeah, well, that was it. They said, well, we want to make a movie. We don't have much money. Okay, guy, yeah,
which follows the rule of James Wan, you know, like horror doesn't have to be expensive.
It's also like two guys in a room. Okay, that's where we start. Well, how did they get there? And it's almost like the movie is like that because it just starts with them in the room and it's like, wait a minute, why are we here? It's almost like the filmmakers themselves have to think about these things.
It creates this feeling of anxiety, you know, just like the one little thing and one little moment and who you're with in the room, completely trapped. It just creates this sense of anxiety. And what the characters see, especially, wouldn't that freak you out?
Yes. Yeah, the setup is decent in that it draws the viewer in. Definitely, and kind of at least unfolds in a way that is fast moving and doesn't keep you bored when you're watching it, you know?
Yeah, because when I watched a movie with like several people, the first thing they commented is like, wow, that room is really shitty. If it's in the studio, they did such a good job making it super crap, you know?
Yeah. Before we get into like the flashback structure of this movie, I will say, like, Dr. Gordon is played by Cary Elwes, who is an English actor, and Lee Whannell, you know, the guy who actually wrote the script and, you know, James Wan's writing partner, plays Adam. One of the problems is I don't think either of these guys are very okay. It's not that Cary Elwes is a bad actor. It's just that he's trying to hide his English accent and it really falls flat. Like, I find like his performance seems very muted, and I get that he's a doctor, like he's supposed to be, but even when he's supposed to be in anguish, there's something very flat-footed about a lot of his delivery that kind of takes me out of it and doesn't make me feel as much as the movie probably wants. And I think Lee Whannell, just as Adam, like, he's not primarily an actor, he's a writer and later filmmaker himself. His character comes across very shrill and whiny in a lot of scenes. And I get like he's under a lot of stress, but it feels more like exaggerated choices in his acting versus what's there in the script, you know? And even some of his dialogue, it feels like his witty lines are a bit desperate, as if Whannell is trying to give himself the best lines in the movie.
It's very strange that in the beginning that Dr. Lawrence was staying, he remained super, super calm while Adam was freaking out, you know, like freaking out completely. Like, I'm not sure how, you know, like in the script, it really, you know, it really shows, you know, like such a genuine reaction coming from Dr. Lawrence's part, right? You know, how is he so calm?
Well, like, they acknowledge that because he's a doctor, so he's going to be thinking through this a little more logically. So I get that. But the problem is later on when he's actually starting to emotionally break down, he realizes
there's this vice versa, you know, this reverse, you know?
Yeah, when his family's, you know, he realizes his family's in trouble. Yeah. The performance there I find very unconvincing. And even, like, there are moments that honestly remind me a little bit of a, you know, Oh, hi, Mark, you know, Tommy Wiseau kind of level. It's not that bad, but it's not great acting. I'll say that.
Yeah, for sure. So did you notice any important symbols in James Wan's movie that he eventually uses in, you know, Conjuring or anything like that? Something that you think is a part of him as a horror otar?
I mean, he has a fascination with, like, the doll, right, in both Annabelle and in Saw. There's a certain, I guess in both, there is a certain aspect of people wanting to reconnect with their lives in some sense, you know. I mean, in Saw, it's much more clear, but in The Conjuring, it's a little more generic with the couple and everything.
Yeah, because I feel like in Saw, it reminds me a little bit of Silence of the Lambs, in a way, like some of the elements there. I'm not sure if you kind of know what I mean, but I see some parallels with that for Saw. No,
I know what you mean. Jigsaw is kind of in that mold of Hannibal Lecter and John Doe from Seven. In fact, this movie does take a lot from Seven, but like the the notion of the philosophical genius serial killer who has these truths that the normal people don't have, but he makes them see the truth, you know, right?
Yeah, because I kind of got this impression that in Saul's part, when, you know, James Wan is like younger and all that, I feel like what he wanted to do was slowly blend into the other movies as well, so that over time he could have his own, you know, artistic signature. That's the way I would see it, but maybe for you might be a bit differently. So what did you think about the plot structure of Saw?
Well, it's kind of interesting to frame it in flashbacks. My only problem is that like the flashbacks within flashbacks get to the point where it's somewhat irritating and it kind of distracts from the main struggle with them in the bathroom. But I get that's part of the point, is them realizing like what in our lives led us up to here. Why did Jigsaw choose that? But I feel like the actual with them in the bathroom, it feels a little underdeveloped, especially along with when you realize the other traps in the movie are much more elaborate and kind of interesting, but also harder to break out of.
Probably it's one way to kill the time, you know, with the clean clock and the going the flashback, you know, to just kill the time before the deadline.
That's exactly
what I would say.
Sometimes it's like, how long are they telling these flashbacks to each other? Because they're in the room for like 6 hours. You know what I mean? It's like, the other thing is like, okay, how these guys are looking around the room to find any way out. How do they not notice anything abnormal about the corpse in the middle of the room? How do they not notice some, you know what I mean? It's this old cancer patient and he's there on lying in the ground. It's like, how could they not pick up that he's breathing in some sense? You could argue that he probably took some kind of drug that, you know, would help him go without breathing. Yeah, you can assume that, but it's also like, we know that the blood there is poisoned, right? And it's like, so he's just sitting there breathing in poison the whole time. But then it's also Jigsaw also has these antidotes to all these things he poisons people with. Is he like a, like how much of a genius is this guy? And yet how does he like come up with all these variables? It's just kind of, it's just contrived, I feel. That's part of my problem.
And yeah, what did you think of again, Jigsaw, you know, Jigsaw himself, the role of Jigsaw, and especially when he's confronted by Inspector and his helper?
I mean, Jigsaw as a character is definitely interesting. I mean, he's not a realistic serial killer, but I think like as a horror film antagonist, this motivation that he has of trying to make people see the value of life through suffering is an interesting idea, and actually has some philosophical parallels with like actual philosophers who believe like suffering leads to a higher realm of human consciousness or being, right? Like Søren Kierkegaard or even like Deleuze or Nietzsche and such. So it's interesting there, but my problem is that sometimes I almost would like to see a character study of Jigsaw himself rather than all the torture stuff, because I find him just kind of an interesting character. And I think
there's something about him that's really mysterious, you know, like if you never watched the Saw franchise before and you just see the first movie, like you would question a lot of things, you know, not just about the torturing part and the victims and all that. You'd really wonder, especially with the costuming and, you know, how he's so obsessed with the color red. I noticed that, especially when the inspectors, they find, you know, a bunch of things left in that room, from the doll to a victim who is tied with the two, you know, screwdrivers, you know, just the size of the ears. I just thought, you know, it's interesting, you know, there's just something, you know, artistic about that, you know, there's artistic signature to it.
Yeah, again, linking him back to like Hannibal and John Doe, these more artistic representations of serial killers, which doesn't really match up with actual real life serial killers. But they find him, they don't see his face, and you know, he's like, he's like, get on the ground, you sick fuck. And he's like, yes, I'm sick, officer. Sick from what's eating me inside. I'm sick of people who can't appreciate their blessings. And I'm sick of those who scoff at the suffering of other people. It's like only like little bits of dialogue that he has. But it does intrigue you as to like what led this guy to this path. And we kind of get the sense like, yeah, it's his cancer in this movie, because we at the end we realize he was Dr. Gordon's cancer patient, who we saw briefly in one scene, though the sequels do give more backstory beyond the cancer that led him to this place. But I think in this first movie alone, even though we don't see him a whole lot necessarily doing much physically, aside from playing dead in the room, it does make you interested in who this guy is necessarily, even as we can poke things in his plans.
But yeah, there are certain, of course, you know, one of the weaknesses in that is not just like the plot structure, but there's also some things that seem, you know, a little bit off, like such as, you know, the acting and in certain characters, but also some of the gadgets, like when Adam pretended to play dead and all that, and then he gets electrocuted with the chain and all that. Where did that come from?
I don't get, like,
I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, is the electrical shock coming from the chain? How do you how do you program that into a chain? You know what I mean?
The chain doesn't look, you know, high tech. It looks like a primitive, you know, chain, right? It's just like a regular ankle chain. I thought that was a little bit off there.
Yeah, and also the other thing, like with the saw, the hacksaws, why don't the guys just try to saw through the pipes, or try to break the pipes? So these really rusty, shitty looking pipes, you know?
Exactly. And the moment where Dr. Lawrence asks Adam to dig into the bowl of toilet instead of just looking the second time there, like, I just thought there were some moments that were just improbable and unrealistic. But I do notice another signature of James Wan thing. It's the obsession of the red color, the color red, associating that with, like, the villains. You also see that similarity with, you know, Conjuring in that sense, but also Insidious too. So if you, like I said, if you ever have the chance to watch, you know, Insidious and Saw, you would see the parallels there, you know?
Yeah, sure. And I think just another, when you mentioned Adam, you know, putting his hand in the toilet and just getting all shit in his hand, he's like, you know, I probably should have checked in that place first.
I thought that it was very strange, that instant reaction. Like, if you were in the character's position, would you have reacted that way? I just thought that there's some little moments where it doesn't really add up. It's not realistic. So that's, like, probably one of the flaws, you know, the flaws of James Wan movies.
Yeah. But I think it's sort of like also because, you know, that's part of Jigsaw's things. He makes these people drudge through shit to find their salvation. But there's a little bit of seed planting when he strategically throws the rest of the black bag into the bathtub, because we later know that the photos he took of Dr. Gordon are in there, right? So gets a little bit of seed planting. It's like, oh, wow, he was quick to just dash that off. But
And I thought, like, it was interesting. There was one thing that caught me in particular at that opening scene, right? So when Dr. Lawrence, he was looking around, then he looks at the clock, he says, oh, it's super clean, someone wants us to know, like, the time and all that. Like, I just thought there's a little bit of self-reflexivity, like, you know, the director himself, or even the writer himself, is aware that, you know, we're watching this, you know, unveil and all that. I thought it was a little bit, you know, strange itself if it were to happen, like, in real life, as you mentioned, it happens in, like, snuffy, you know, films and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's after this that, like, Dr. Gordon realizes, okay, we're in, you know, this is a trap set by the Jigsaw killer. But I'm like, how did it take him this long to realize that? Especially when we know Jigsaw was trying to set him up in the past, you know? How did it take him this long? But anyway, that does lead us into the flashbacks where we see, Danny Glover as a Detective Tapp, who I think Danny Glover does fine in terms of his performance. It's just a really cliche kind of role of, you know, the obsessed on the edge cop, obsessed with his case and everything. This is kind of a cliche role you'd find in a lot of standard serial killer cop procedural type movies and shows.
Yeah, and the flashbacks too, I don't know why it would take so long, right? I'm not sure how many hours they were in that room, but I remember, like, the deadline was at 6, right? What was the first time? Was it around, like, 10 or... you know, 11 or something like that? Or
I think they had 6 hours to be in that room. Why was it? Yeah, I already mentioned that. But another thing to point out, the editing in this movie is like really choppy and frantic. And I know why they did that. It's because of the budgetary reasons. They had to work around some of their limitations with that editing. But that editing really comes across like very obnoxious MTV. Like, look how extreme we are in some scenes when they can't show everything, right? And especially at the end, it comes across a little pretentious, but...
But I think it creates at least, you know, a little bit of a reaction from the audience. I think that was the whole purpose of it. Because if it would have, you know, just stayed completely still, you know, the whole time, you know, we you know, the audience wouldn't be reacting as much. You know, there wouldn't be much reaction out of them, you know?
Sure, sure. And I think James Wan likes the idea of just doing things for effect, right? That thrill ride you would get in a horror film. He likes that idea, right? So.
Yeah, you know, like to escalate, you know, the situation, you know, and for the audience to feel that, you know, tension.
Yeah, so we get the flashbacks, and like the first flashback, they find the first Jigsaw victim, who was someone who attempted suicide, and Jigsaw was like, you know, well, when you tried to cut your wrists, did you actually want to die or did you just want attention? You're going to prove that to me. So he placed him in a basement filled with razor and barbed wire. And he said, like, if you want to live, you're going to have to cut yourself again. Or you, if you want to die, you can just stay where you are. But he tried to fight through, and we see like the struggle with that really hyper editing, that hyper intensified editing. And yeah, he basically just bled to death because of the straight razor wire. So it's, yeah, that's obviously a very literal connection to that guy's life. And then the second one is, okay, this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, this con artist, you know, who burned people, you know, would rip people off and such. You know, Jigsaw has put this guy naked in this room. He has smeared his whole body in a flammable wax. Yeah, and he's poisoned him, and there's an antidote that has to be in the safe. And at the antidote, the code to the safe is written all over the wall in this room, and it can only be seen with a lit candle, an unprotected lit candle, while this guy has to step on broken glass over and over again. It's like, okay, you have to have the coordination of a master ballet dancer, I think, to actually get through this alive. Because, like, and how is Jigsaw not a killer at this point, even though they say he's never murdered anybody? Like, my ass, like, no, this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you on that part.
Yeah, they just like, no way this guy could have made it out of that alive. I feel, yeah. And then we get you know, how Dr. Gordon was first introduced to Jigsaw, you know, because Jigsaw stole his pen light and he left it at the scene of the crime, which in itself is kind of strange. Like, how would they find Dr. Gordon's prints on the pen light? Because he's not a criminal. He's not an offender. They wouldn't have his prints, right?
Yeah. But I also thought it's a little bit, you know, I thought the role, not just Jigsaw's role, interesting, but I find, you know, the inspector, something about the inspector's role, you know, very, how should I say this? Like, it's a little bit unusual to me. I'm not sure why they have the inspector involved with the whole problem situation thing, you know?
It's because it's just playing into the old cliches of, you know, the obsessed cop and everything who's bending the rules to get the bad guy kind of thing, right?
Yeah, but then he pays Adam, right? To take photos and to spy on Dr. Lawrence.
Yeah.
So I just thought it's weird. How come the inspector's not kidnapped himself, right?
Yeah. Well, Jigsaw already hurt him in some way, but...
Yeah, he already did, but the thing is, how come he wasn't, you know, the inspector wasn't kidnapped in the first place if he was part of that whole sin thing?
Actually, we'll get to that. I could have something to say about that when we talk about the specific scene where the detectives, you know, find Jigsaw's lair. But,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we get set up with Zepp, who is sort of the red herring in the movie. He's the one who's actually you know, he's the orderly. He's like, oh, he's a very interesting person. His name is John. And we later find that guy's the Jigsaw killer, though for a while we're led to believe it's Zepp. And we see Dr. Gordon's like, you know, well, thanks, Zepp. You see, the orderlies form special bonds with the patients. It just shows him as kind of a glib, like kind of superficial in his treatment with his patients, right? That you can see how that would set him up in Jigsaw's purview. Yeah, then we get when Dr. Gordon has to listen to the testimony of Amanda, who in the sequels becomes Jigsaw's protege. She was a drug addict. She's placed in the reverse bear trap, which would rip open her
jaw.
Her jaw. And that's very symbolic because, you know, she stepped into a trap herself with her drug addiction that will kill her from the inside. So the reverse bear trap very much signifies that. And then she's forced to kill this guy who's been injected with anesthetics. So, but he's still alive. So she kills this guy to find the key inside his body.
Digging into the stomach,
Yeah, and again, how is Jigsaw not a killer? She literally had forced
the... And then he says, dead soulmate. What do you think of that?
Yeah, he almost tried to convince her that, like, he was dead, but he wasn't. Yes, yeah, she breaks free, and then the puppet rolls out, and he's like, you know, so many people are ungrateful to be alive, but not you, not anymore. And then, you know, in the present day, Amanda's like, he helped me, which I guess sets up that she becomes his protege in the sequels. But I also feel like anybody who would live through shit like that, even if they were like, I'm glad I'm alive, you'd be fucking traumatized the rest of your life. The fact that somebody put you through shit like that.
Yeah, it's like, I also kind of thought of one thing about the atoning the sins part. So even though, like, the inspector, you know, has been involved with the conflict between Dr. Lawrence and Adam, it seems as if James Wan tried to have the character himself kind of making that up by trying to help Dr. Lawrence's, you know, family.
Yeah.
From Jigsaw. So I just kind of noticed that now that you've mentioned about the other characters and their dilemma.
Yeah. And then it's after, yeah. So Tap and his partner Singh, they're able to trace Jigsaw's location by analyzing the video. And they go to, the lair where they find a victim has now been set up with razors about to penetrate his neck. And so Jigsaw activates it, and he says, like, you know, you have only a few seconds to unlock this man and save him. And, you know, this is when he gives his, you know, speech about how he's sick of everybody, and he cuts Tap's throat, and Singh, the other one, is able to shoot the lock and save the other guy. But Singh runs off. He guns down Jigsaw with his gun, though Jigsaw obviously survives, probably a bulletproof vest. And then he wanders into a trap filled with shotguns aiming down at his head, and they just blow him to pieces when he trips over the wire. And yeah, Jigsaw gets away. But in the script, it's different. An informant of Tap's actually says, like, I know where Jigsaw is. And it turns out it was all a trap for Tap. It was like his test Jigsaw was putting him through. He's like, are you going to save the life of this man, or are you going to arrest me? You know, it's that whole thing. And it's like, you failed both accounts. You've cost yourself two lives, which he does. The informant dies in the script, as well as Singh, of course. So, like, there's, like, the whole thing of them going to the warehouse and everything. That was actually a planned-out test Jigsaw had for the detective, whereas in this, it's more just happenstance and improvisation on his part.
Yeah, and you also, even though, like, other franchises for Saw and all that, you know, like, the ending, it's a little less gruesome. At least Dr. Lawrence got, you know, escaped somehow, you know, like, the characters are somehow, even though they're harmed and all that, they still manage to kind of resolve their own problems. That's temporary. It's also similar to Conjuring, and that's just one thing that James Wan tries to do, right? To just make it a little less, you know, miserable, even though, you know, the whole thing is, even though it's horror itself, you know, like, he just tries to make that little happy ending thing.
I think it's after that we get a flashback to Dr. Gordon at his home, where you know, his daughter is scared of somebody in her room, and then who then later kidnaps them. It's not too bad, where, like, you know, he's like, we get a sense of the family dynamic and stuff, that Dr. Gordon doesn't really appreciate his family to the fullest that he has. Of course, though he still does have affection for them, he's not being a very good father or husband really at all. Yeah, we get we cut back to them in the room, which again took way too fucking long for them to explain this stuff to each other. But they look in, and Adam sees that one photo has been replaced in Dr. Gordon's wallet, where photos of his wife and daughter gagged right at their bed. But Adam doesn't show it, and then X marks the spot, right? From that photo, they're able to turn off the lights and see the glow in the dark paint, which gives Dr. Gordon the cell phone, which only receives calls, and the cigarettes, which are a way for him to kill Adam with.
Yeah, and at least they didn't kill each other. At least they didn't try to kill each other, except when the doctor himself went really, when he went into a maniac episode and, shoots Adam on the arm and shoulder and all that.
Yeah, that's near the end, yeah.
But I just think it's strange. Well, I just think it's interesting and strange at the same time how James Wan chose, to have the inspector not being kidnapped and all that, even though he would try to make up all this, all his sins and all that. But then you mentioned, so it's interesting of the inspector's role, because he's not part of the inside problem.
Yeah.
And he would try to, make it up by, rescuing the characters. But then again, why would James Wan not make, him the victim necessarily, even though he had his throat slashed and all that, Even though you said there's this cliche of this obsessive cop and whatsoever, how come he was able to spy on Jigsaw when he's sticking out the window and all that, right?
Well, he set up he's not spying on Jigsaw, he's spying on Zep, who we're led to believe is Jigsaw, yeah. Right? But he set up across from Dr. Gordon's house, right, with these cameras and such.
Yeah, because wouldn't the antagonists in the movie know that they're being, spied on too, usually?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I find that's the thing, is that when you juxtapose them in the room versus everything else, it almost feels like the confine of the budget. It's that I feel like James Wan almost wants to make something a little more mobile and dynamic rather than confined, which conflicts with the initial premise of these characters confined in the room. So that's what I mean. The flashbacks in the present just feel awkward in terms of the rhythm of the movie, I feel.
Yeah, and also sometimes with whose flashbacks, with who, the moment where Adam revealed, where Adam revealed that he was taking photos and following Dr. Lawrence around. I think that part was a little bit awkward.
All of a sudden they're it's kind of cheesy. It's I remember everything now.
Yeah, I thought that part was a little bit cheesy, because then when he reveals that, whose perspective are we seeing in the flashback? Adam's or Dr. Lawrence,
Yeah, we both know that they were kidnapped by Jigsaw wearing the pig mask.
Yeah,
which obviously signifies, look at yourselves, you mindless pigs, right? Though in the sequels, they made it more literal. He kidnapped his first person while at a pig, a celebration involving pig masks. So, but in this movie, it's very much clear, March of the Pigs, Nine Inch Nails, stupid masses that he views these people as. But anyway, yeah, I think it's when they decide, okay, we're gonna fake Adam's death, right, with the cigarettes. So, but first off, Dr. Gordon's, "God damn you, what are you doing to them?" is really bad acting. he can't do his American accent very well. But anyway, so they turn off the lights, which what would that do to the audio of them talking? But anyway, so yeah, and they're like, "Yeah, give me the cigarette." And then Adam's fake out death.
Yeah, and then this electrocution thing. Where did that come from?
Yeah, but Adam's fake out death of just the it's so bad.
Yeah, I've had people laughing to that actually.
I know that's the point, that it is a bad acting that Adam and the character is doing that's unconvincing, but even Lee Whannell playing the scene is it's too much of a bad actor.
It's dramatic, overly dramatic.
They get the phone call where Dr. Gordon's mm-hmm. wife is being forced to say, like, don't believe Adam, you know, don't believe his lies. And then this one, yeah, we find out that Adam was paid by Tap, the detective, to spy on Dr. Gordon. And in this, he had photos of Dr. Gordon at that motel where he was cheating on his wife with the med student, which I found that's another strange scene when she's like, you know, what's wrong, Dr. Gordon? It's like, it kind of seems like, why would she call him that if they've been doing this for a while? Are they implying that they're just starting this? But it's like, it says months ago that he was seeing somebody who wasn't a patient, right? Yeah. So it's like, no, he's been with this student for a while, you know, but that scene just plays really strange in the way the dialogue is handled.
Yeah, but, I agree with you.
Yeah, but I also think it's there to take Dr. Gordon down a peg, you know, because he's like, Adam, you're a bottom feeder and stuff. But it's like, hey, you're cheating on your wife, right? So it's like putting them on the same level, because Adam says, like, face it, we're both bullshitters, right?
Yeah.
We reveal, yeah, he finds out that Zep is the one holding Dr. Gordon's family hostage, but he sees him in the picture that was in the bag, right? But yeah. it looks like the picture was taken by Tap, like the detective, like from his perspective. You know, like, was Zep just there the night when Adam was taking pictures and he just snapped that? Because Adam doesn't seem to remember taking that photo. So that's a little strange.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Michael Emerson plays Zep too much like a villain when you see it. And I know that's like, because you're leading him to believe that he is the bad guy. But the thing is, we know he's just a victim at the end of it, too. He's just a pawn of this whole thing. But he plays him too much like, I'm going to kill your husband now, Mrs. Gordon, and everything. Like, he comes across too sinister, I feel, in his performance. But also, we know that Zep was, yeah, he was poisoned, and he's being asked to carry this out to get the antidote from Jigsaw. But the thing is, like, what would happen if Dr. Gordon and Adam failed their thing? Dr. Gordon failed. Like, would Zep have just killed the wife and daughter? That would make Jigsaw a murderer. He literally ordered this guy to murder these two people.
Yeah.
And also, why the hell is Zep not wearing a mask?
Yeah, and then he's wearing that suit, you know? That samurai-looking suit.
Yeah, it's like, but the thing is, it's like, after this is all done, even if Dr. Gordon breaks out, what the fuck is Zep gonna do? They know his face. He works with Dr. Gordon, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, why is he showing his face? It doesn't make sense. It's just there for dramatic effect of Zep, the orderly. What are you doing, you bastard? It's, you know. Yeah, but eventually, yeah, Dr. Gordon's wife escapes, and then, you know, Tap comes in to save them, and he pursues Zep, and then they try to call Dr. Gordon on the phone, but the phone was flung a little bit out of reach because of the electrical shock, and he's like crying. He's like, no, I can't reach it. I can't reach it. It's like, why don't you just take off your shirt and fling it at it? It's not like that far.
Yeah, off. Taking off the shirt. Yeah, that part I was, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's just like, I can't do it. I have to saw my... And he saws his foot off, which they weren't that graphic with, which even... It's the most one of the most famous scenes in the movie. It's...
Yeah, exactly.
They're not that graphic with. They're decently tasteful with it. But then the problem is that, like, he's, like, pale, right? And he's just like...
Yeah, too pale.
And he's like... You know, even after he's like, you're gonna have to die. And he's like, every after he shoots Adam, he's like,
yeah, Adam is not as pale as Dr. Lawrence, though, even though he was shot. It's yeah. So uneven. Like, I've had people point that out, you know, too much makeup.
Even after he shot him, he's just crying, show my family to me. It's like, your suffering is too muted for this. But then the other problem is, he wouldn't even be consciousness after, sawing his own foot off. He'd probably have passed out from shock, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also, even after he saws his foot off, what happened to the phone? Where did it go?
Good question. The disappeared phone, the vanished phone.
I know. Why doesn't he try to get the phone after he sawed his foot off?
Yeah.
Whatever. And then, yeah, Zep comes in. And he's like, you're going to have to die now, Dr. Gordon, because it's the rules. But then Adam just takes him off by his feet and then just
smashes with the...
Yeah, just beats him, beats his ass to death. And then Dr. Gordon promises, you know, I'll be back with help, I promise, or else I'm going to bleed to death. And then Adam's like, okay, he's got to have a key in here. But then he finds the tape revealing that Zep isn't Jigsaw. He's just a pawn in the in his plan. And then that's when the real Jigsaw, John Kramer, rises up from the middle. And then we hear that music playing, that, you know, that constantly elevating music of the same notes, right? But just at the higher pitch each time. The music's pretty cool. It makes it feel a lot more epic than it probably does, you know? And but even Adam's just reaction, he's just like jaw dropped. You know what I mean? It's like what the movie's trying to make the audience feel, you know? But like I said, there's some things you can point out, but just the visceral effect of that, it's decent, like on the gut level in the audience. I think the reveal works well.
Yeah, I think that overall, it's for people who are afraid of watching, you know, slasher movies, but this one, it isn't extremely, extremely graphic. There's some graphic parts, but not extreme. I think that one is, you know, watchable for these kind of audiences, you know?
Yeah. And then, so then it ends with, Jigsaw saying basically, you know, at least you're grateful to be alive, Adam, but you failed. Game over. And he seals him in the room to basically just leaving him to die.
He's alive until,
Yeah, but he pretty much dies in that room of starvation and everything, so.
Yeah.
But, so overall, Saw, I think it's definitely something that made its way in the culture, but as a thing itself, I feel like it doesn't amount to much more than an interesting, albeit fucked up concept, executed decently well in places. I feel like it doesn't really amount to much more than that. That's my thing. That's my assessment of it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But yeah, overall, it's like watchable. It's, you know, keeps us really suspended and all that, suspenseful, you know, like our eyes are constantly glued to the screen. So I think that overall it's a success, you know. It brought back the horror genre, especially as a horror movie fan.
It's definitely made its impact and for a reason, you know, and spawned probably the most iconic horror franchise of the 2000s. So, and they did it all with very minimal means and a low budget. So you got to hand it to James Wan and Lee Whannell, right? So,
yep. And now we'll be moving on to The Conjuring.
Nice. From
2013. Now, The Conjuring is very interesting because if you look at it, you know, in Google or even the internet, it's always considered as one of the top 20 or top 10 most scariest movies to watch of all time. It has a lot of titles frequently, and it is based on a true story. So The Conjuring is about paranormal investigators, Ed and Lorraine Warren, who try to help the Perron family in Rhode Island, because they live in a house where there is a evil entity who's constantly being harassing that family of seven, five girls, and we have the parents Roger and Carol, and that's what the story is about. It is based on a true story, as I mentioned, but yeah. This is one of the most scariest movies I've ever seen, especially the sequel one itself. But what's really special about it is he puts great emphasis on the sound, you know? Like, as you mentioned towards the end for the Saw, you know, the creepy sound. Well, there's a lot of creepy sound, especially with Conjuring. There's this manipulation of, you know, the dead silence and, you know, the violins, the super loud violins, you know, towards the beginning, and especially when something ominous is coming up. And he applied very well his, you know, his rules for making a successful film, which one of them is to be conscious of, you know, the sounds you put, not just the visuals. The sound puts great importance, plays a major role.
I would say this film, I find the concepts of Saw to be more interesting just from a conceptual level, but I think The Conjuring definitely shows a great leap ahead for James Wan in terms of his craft and techniques. I think this is quite a really impressively made film just on a technical level. I think he does some interesting things, like you said, with sound, but also with camera. Like he's the way he uses long takes, as well as even blending like a certain docudrama moment with the documentary cameras in that one scene, and his use of these self-reflexive moments, right, with just cameras and the idea of this of conjuring up these stories, right, itself. But also it's just, you mentioned it's based on a true story, but if you read up on the real Warren people, you probably realize that they're likely con artists, kind of conned and manipulated people in their career. But this movie takes them completely at their word, right? The supernatural exists in this film. And it's almost like, with all the references to technology and cameras, it's almost like it's saying that horror in itself is something that we construct as fiction. It's not like horror is essentially unreal, and it feels like, and by distorting real history to make it so explicitly supernatural, it's sort of like James Wan is making a self-reflexive commentary on horror filmmaking in that sense. Which I find interesting.
Yeah, and especially like, you know, in Saw, you had the cell phones and whatsoever. We're basically comparing, you know, a psychological, you know, horror and suspense to like the more supernatural. But technology definitely plays a major important role, because in the opening scene of The Conjuring, you have the paranormal investigators, Ed and Lorraine Warren, who basically show the case of the doll Annabelle, right? And that was on a projector, right? It was showing that story, and it was telling it to their students about the whole, you know, the paranormal investigation thing. So I think that in a way, there's already this self-reflexivity, and especially from a spiritual point of view for a lot of, you know, paranormal investigators in real life and whatsoever, in order to be able to capture, you know, like supernatural activities or anything that's paranormal, you know, in historical times, you only had a candle itself, right? Yeah. And that would show, especially in like conjuring scenes when they try to do seances, right? But as history goes on, technology becomes more advanced. So paranormal investigators in the historical times, they would create technology such as the EMF or, you know, recorder, audio recorder, especially that's designed specifically for the spirituality area, for that department. So I just thought that it's interesting that he would use that connection in Conjuring to be able to make that the relationship between the movie itself and the audience who are watching, you know, to kind of keep up to date with modernity in that sense, even though it was set around, you know, the 60s, around that time. I liked it, the scene where Lorraine reveals, you know, when she first meets like the Perron family, when she reveals that there's this dark entity that's been following them. You see like this dark shadow with the family, then you see the dark this and dark that, and then when the camera just moves slowly away, you see the tree and the person, you know, hanging, and the sound becomes super loud, right? The film music, right? I thought he did a good job on that, and I thought it was very creepy, like eerily creepy. Yeah, because they show a lot of landscapes. I noticed they show like a lot of the backgrounds. I noticed they show more that than they did for Saw.
Yeah, well, he has a bigger budget this time. But also, even like the scenes of like where it's like people walking through the house, it's kind of like, okay, this is a predictable setup we get in horror films. But like he does it well because he uses the shadows of the house really well. And also he doesn't rely on the obvious cheap audio visual tricks of jump scares, I feel, too often throughout this movie. Like, there's almost a scientific quality to the way he's taking these sort of cliched setups and elements and not going super far with them to the point where it becomes aggravating, which...
But also, you notice, like, the paranormal investigator, there's an Asian assistant, just like how in Saw there was an Asian assistant for the inspector, right? So you can kind of see, like, you know, he tries to add diversity there, even though it's set during, you know, during the 60s, where there's a racial segregation still happening, and we're slowly moving towards, you know, the civil rights there and whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
And racial, and the awareness of, like, racial inequality, you know, like raising awareness over that, right?
Yeah, I actually find it interesting, like, how it's set in the late 60s. Well, obviously because what this is based on happened there.
Yeah.
But this movie, I don't know if you're familiar with Robin Wood's concepts of progressive versus reactionary horror. The monster in a horror is a threat to the status quo or normality. It's what's been repressed by society, and it leaves open the possibility of the threat to normality continuing to happen, whereas reactionary horror is, you know, the repressed is contained and the status quo is reaffirmed. The thing about this is that I feel like this is a kind of reactionary horror because it says, like, yes, good and evil, these demons, they're very pure. And then, like, it's the Christian, you know, exorcism stuff that is able to repel.
Yeah. This, and then there was this issue where the family, they weren't, you know, baptized, none of the kids and all that. So it was hard for them to find help because they couldn't get help from the church and because they weren't baptized, as I mentioned. So they had to try to find a way to reach to, you know, the paranormal investigators.
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of like it's the power of Christianity in overcoming evil, right? That, and, you know, the idea of the family values were very much reinstated in this movie. And it's interesting that it takes place in the late 60s during the time of counterculture when those kind of traditional values are being questioned, right? So it honestly makes presenting a story in that time makes it an even more kind of conservative story. And that's what I feel is that the content of this movie I don't find super terribly interesting. I find it kind of boilerplate, but I just appreciate James Wan's style as well as his self-reflexivity in what he's doing as a horror filmmaker, as a very self-conscious maker of unreal horror.
He combines a lot of, you know, classical horror and, you know, classical cinematic conventions, especially like film noir and all that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you've noticed that especially, but
in Saw, definitely neo-noir, sure.
Yeah, for sure. And even Conjuring, I thought that it was genius on James Wan's part where the kids, they basically play hide and seek in the sense where they have to, you know, blindfold themselves and spin around and try to look for them, you know, while they're blindfolded. I thought that in a way he's putting great emphasis on sound itself, you know, like diegetic and non-diegetic, but he's putting a lot of emphasis on diegetic because have you ever tried, you know, watching the movie, but then at that moment you just try to spin and you close your eyes and all that, you know, like I've tried doing that, you know, like at the same time as the character to try to put it into the perspective there. And I think it's pretty spooky. Not gonna lie, I think it's pretty spooky, you know, whether you close your eyes or not, especially over that movie, you know, it just makes you even more aware of your senses, not just, you know, visually, but also in terms of touching and, you know, hearing and sensing and so forth.
Yeah, sure. It's almost like he's like a formalist. He's more obsessed with, sound and visuals than in the story, because the story is kind of, like I said, it is kind of this reactionary, kind of conservative horror story that in a lot of ways has a lot of cliches and is hacky. You know, you get them finding old dusty stuff in a rural house that one just moved into. You get the dead animals as the omen signs and everything. You get, you know, the family dynamic being split up but then reintegrated and things like that. But that's my thing, is that, like, I can appreciate Juan as a filmmaker in this, but not so much the material. That's what I feel.
Yeah, I agree on you for that part, actually. Have you seen the exorcism part of The Conjuring?
Well, yeah. Yeah, of course. That's like the climax of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. What did you think about that?
I mean, the effect, I mean, obviously, it's very in your face. It's not like subtle, but that's not a problem. But it's like, the effect is interesting when they're, you know, they douse her in the ghost sheet, like, cause making her like a ghost, right? Cause yeah. You know, she's going away. She's
possessed, yeah.
Yeah, but it's almost like she's gone. She's like just a shell, like a ghost of herself. But it is surprising just how well it actually works. You know what I mean? It's almost like where it's very literal, the exorcism works, whereas in The Exorcist, the Exorcist film, you know, 1973, they don't actually spell the demon from Reagan in the original Exorcist. You know, the priest is like, you know, stop, take me, and he allows himself to be possessed by the demon, and he forces himself to kill himself. So it's almost like the priest letting in evil has to let in evil to himself in order to defeat it, which whereas The Conjuring, it contains evil in the sense that it's like there is this thing that infiltrates human lives and it can be expelled. You know what I mean?
Which part did you thought was the scariest in the movie?
The scariest? I actually kind of like the part when the youngest daughter was like, there's somebody there. There's somebody there, but we can't see.
Yeah.
The jump scare is actually, I thought was decent because it almost does set it up that they're not going to see it at this point. And we actually don't see it, but we know it's doing something. And I think the child actress sells the fear very well in that scene. And even just that idea, like somebody we don't know is in our house and he's like just staring at me. Like there's something uncanny and very creepy about that, I feel.
Yeah. And I thought the scene where Lorraine talks to the mother of the family, Carol, she was touching the picture, and you get this flashback, but it shows that she has the vision of them where they went to the beach and all that.
She's a clairvoyant. She has the
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that scene, I just don't. I can see a little bit of the connection where she would try to have when Carol was possessed and trying to chase down her youngest to try to kill her and all that. I thought that, you know, that scene in particular to use it to be able to convince Carol to fight the Bathsheba, which is, you know, the evil ghost, right, that's possessing her. I don't know. I just thought that James Wan could have done something else a bit differently for that.
Well, I think there may be the idea like she's clairvoyant, like she can sense other people. It's like, you know, sensing things beyond this world, right? But also sensing the inner lives of these people, you know, like that's the point. But I agree, it is a kind of odd.
Yeah, I think it's odd because it already shows she's a clairvoyant when she reveals to, you know, to her husband, Ed, that, you know, she saw something with them that's following around. And, you know, you have this black shadow with them everywhere they go. But I just thought, you know, I just thought it was strange. Not strange, but maybe, you know, James Wan could have, you know, done a bit differently on the ghost part. Because when Carol was, like, possessed by the evil spirit, you know, Bathsheba and all that, you see, like, the face, right? But then it's completely different when it's like as a small shadow. The shadow looked pretty small, you know what I mean? For that revelation. But what's really, I just thought it was very strange that James Wan showed that face, because in real life, you know, Bathsheba, there's no photographs of the person at all. The only thing they have as evidence is a woman standing at the farmhouse with just the mask on, you know?
Yeah, and the other thing is that, like, if someone's possessed, the other people aren't going to see it as the demon, you know what I mean? Like, we know that the Bathsheba possessed somebody centuries ago to kill her daughter, right? And then she was framed for the witch trial. But it's like these people didn't see the demon, they just saw a witch, who they saw what they thought was a witch, right? So yeah, it's a strange
choice. But I thought they did a good job on the exorcism part. I think they did a good job in terms of like the cinematic effects, you know? Like there was one moment where she floats up very quiet and eventually everything, you know, tumbles down and then people become injured and all that. So I liked that part. That stunt was great. Like the stunts all the stunts in there is great, but I totally agree with you. Like, the story itself, like, the way the plot is structured, that could have been, you know, more polished instead of just following just the classical itself. Maybe if there was, like, a deeper layers or something that, you know.
That's what I mean, is that the story feels so pared down to those classical things. Like, the dialogue and the characters are so schematic, like the frightened child, you know, the skeptical cop who comes to help them, and, you know, the loving parents who are just only concerned for the family. This, you know, and I think, like, the acting is decent. I think even Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, who play the Warrens, I think actually do bring some sensitivity and subtlety to their performances, I think. But in general, everything, the dialogue, it all feels very schematic, very, like, simplified, like a blueprint almost.
I was going to say something. Oh, yeah, about the dog, you know? The death of the dog and all that. Like, I think for in other, like, James Wan's movie and all that, I'm glad that he didn't show, like, the whole graphic part, you know, when something is up, you know? But in Saw, you showed the dead body laying down, right? Yeah. But then after that, the rest of the time, he doesn't really show much of the other graphic parts. So I thought it was, I think it's a good thing that he didn't completely show, like, the all graphics part in The Conjuring. Except what I would say the most graphic part in The Conjuring is really when during the exorcism and all that, she spits out Carol, she spits out, like, all that blood and all that. And then later on, when she was hidden under the white cloth, right, it showed the face and all that, you know. I thought that was very creepy.
Yeah, and I'll say about the acting, this is the second time Lily Taylor, who plays Carol, has appeared in something I've discussed on this podcast. And in both cases, I wasn't super impressed by her acting chops in either, but, like, the other movies she was in, The Addiction, she just had to deliver this, like, really contrived, pretentious, philosophical dialogue that she wasn't able to sell really with much conviction. And in this, she has similarly schematic, stripped-down dialogue, but at least it's not pretentious. Like, the movie is not aspiring to something, like, higher than itself, so at least, like, it's not, like, a winning performance in this film either, but at least the pretension isn't there. That doesn't bother me, so...
Yeah, and you know the small musical box?
Yeah, I was going to ask, that has the spiral. What do you think of that, like, as symbolism or whatever?
I know, like, James Wan, you know, he wants to add an element that's associated with, like, a child, right? So a doll sometimes is associated with a child. But in the opening scene, you have Annabelle. That is a different case. So I feel like this musical box is used to kind of make up that presence, you know? But I think that James Wan could have, because there's another friendly spirit, a friendly ghost, you know, a little boy ghost that the little girl has been talking about. But then we ended up focusing mostly on the bad ghost. But the only time we saw the boy ghost where he says he's scared and all that was really when... You know, the first time the musical box is open, the character sees, you know, briefly sees behind, right? I wish they could have showed him that a bit more. But I just feel like because he isn't, you know, that ghost isn't much in the, it doesn't show much presence. I feel like this fills, like, the whole of that presence, you know?
Yeah, I
agree. That's what I would say, you know? That artifact just fills that vacuum, you know, the vacuum, the presence of, like, a child that would be involved, you know, in the horror movie itself. Even though there's, like, the five kids itself, there's always going to be, you know, a child that either suffers in a tragic event, or if it's someone who, or if it's a child who's, like, who is currently facing trouble, like in Saw, where you have Dr. Lawrence's daughter, you know, being kidnapped and all that. But in this case, I feel like it's served as, like, the presence of the ghost child. You know what I mean? That's what I would say.
I almost wonder if it's a commentary on, like, the childlike primitive fears associated with horror and supernatural stuff, right? It's almost like a little self-reflexivity on the essential childlike nature of these things. Because in these stories, it's always a child that's experiences the supernatural stuff
Yeah, exactly.
Are the worst, right? So
the musical box, it has a small little spiral inside. Spiral is like a form of hypnosis. Just one way to look at it. And it looks like a circus tent, you know? Like the white red stripe thing.
It does. And I was kind of wondering, there's a little shot when they're zooming in on the farmhouse. Yep. There's like, it's like the vertigo zoom, you know what I mean? Where it's like, exactly, it stays still. But then also the spiral, it's like vertigo, like Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. Yeah. I wonder if he's making a little bit of a reference to that.
I see a bit of similarities with the Alfred Hitchcock. I agree with you in some of James Wan's movies. Like, for instance, in Saw, I saw a little bit of, you know, Psycho, elements of Psycho in there somehow.
Well, Psycho kind of starts the whole fascination with serial killers in film, right?
the slasher genre. But yeah, that's what I kind of thought too, you know, the hypnosis and the vertigo thing. That's what I kind of thought.
Also, another like interesting formal choice was during the long take when the parent family is first moving into the house. We hear that song Time of the Season by the Zombies playing. I love that song. It's a great song, but it's something that's very much associated with late 60s, right? You know, it's a 60s pop band. You know, it has an air of like, you know, the counterculture Vietnam kind of thing, and it obviously sets it up for the time that this movie set in, but Time of the Season, it's like the season, like Halloween, you know, kind of spooky season. It was nice to hear that song in the movie just because I like the song and I like the long take. It had a nice dynamic feel.
Yeah. Well. And then I don't know if it was towards the ending or something, but I know that James Wan uses Elvis Presley's song, you know, Falling in Love with You, which he later uses on in The Conjuring 2, you know. I thought it's, you know, like, the fact that he continues that, it's cheesy, but it just, but it does create like a connection with the historical time, I guess. That's what I would say.
Yeah, he's a very self-aware filmmaker in terms of his, even the cliches that he's using, I think. I think there is like a self-reflexivity, but also a calculated commercial quality to what he's doing as well.
Yeah. Even though like it focuses on more spiritual stuff, I see there's a lot of similarities with, you know, with Saw in a way, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a lot. It's
on different fears.
There's a line where it's like the character said, like, we have little to live for, right? The Warrens say that, you know, and everything. And, you know, Saw is all about forcing yourself to find something to live for, right? Whereas in Saw, it's much more brutal.
Based on what you said, what do you think James Wan is trying to convey to the audience based on that similarity you just pointed out?
Perhaps he views in that very classical idea of horror as a sense of catharsis, you know, of going through these, something that's scary, a little emotionally troubling, but, you know, enough self-reflexive distance that allows the audience to come out unharmed, but at least thinking, having something more positive reaffirmed, perhaps.
Yeah, I know, like, for Saw and Conjuring, even though it's not in the first Conjuring, the second one, towards the end of the second Conjuring, it emphasized a lot on the tape recorder where Ed tries to break the code. It just reminds me of from Saw where Dr. Lawrence, you know, tries to crack the code using this recorder. Yeah. And I think James Wan has this obsession with the recorder, you know, like going the reverse, the pausing, you know.
Yeah, I think that's just maybe his formalist tendencies, his obsession with images and sounds versus storytelling, perhaps, right?
Yeah, I think so too. And also the color, I'm not sure if you noticed, but the color filters for Conjuring and Saw is very different.
Like, yeah, Saw has a much more gritty look, and it even uses more stylish greens and reds and stuff.
More stylized in terms of color. And then The Conjuring is like sepia, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it feels like a more modern version of like the 70s horror kind of thing.
Yeah, like a little bit warm tone kind of. That's what I've noticed. Just remember something. So when the mother plays the hide and seek, blindfolding hide and seek thing, she was wearing a red blindfold, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing to keep in mind. And that red thing, it's basically foreshadowing, right? It's foreshadowing of her, you know, being possessed and something bad is going to happen to her. So like I said, the red is very important to look out for because it means, you know, it means the villain, right? Who is the villain and all that in that sense. But she's not the villain, but she's possessed by the villain, you know?
Yeah, very clear. And I mean, in Saw 2, Jigsaw's black and red robe, right? Yeah. It's like a red is very associated with the devil, right?
Yeah, and it, the same thing in Conjuring 2, if you go in the internet and find the front cover, the little girl is wearing the red nightgown. So it just shows, you know, and she's the one getting possessed again. So I just think that, you know, he likes to associate with red a lot. And especially, you know, for things like Insidious, the monster's face is red, especially, you know. So red doesn't just represent blood to him. I think it just represents villain. I'm not sure if there's other kinds of representations of the color red that I can think of. But I think it's strange because the you know, the small musical box we talked about, the toy musical box thing?
Yeah.
That one is red and white too. So I'm not sure what that would signify, the red on this toy.
Well, it's sort of like the perversion of innocence, you could say. Like white kind of represents purity in a lot of movies and like even just in art and such. You know, it's like the red, the villainy, it's perverting that innocence. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because I thought it was strange that there was the red there itself. And it looks like this clown thing, you know, the circus, you know, clown tent. But then there's the little doll, right? But I thought that it's strange. Yeah, in the beginning, you know, Annabelle is shown. But then later on, James Wan decides to, you know, be the producer for the Annabelle films. But I just thought that, yeah, probably it's a good way to start up like that. But how come they don't show, like, you know, other dolls in the house or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, the Annabelle doll is something they dealt with in the past, right?
But so that's a completely different family.
Story.
That's a completely different family, though.
Yeah.
Because then when the family started to have issues, you know, with paranormal activity, they, you know, Carol, the mother, tries to reach out to them, right? But she was basically looking at them, you know, like the performance of an exorcism, right? As Lorraine was presenting that, right? So I feel like this one has a lot of foreshadowing. In Saw, there was a lot of foreshadowing thing, but I noticed that it's when it's in the precise time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, as I mentioned before in the reference in the past, oh, Lawrence says, oh yeah, the clock, someone wants us to know the time. Okay, you know, like it's happening currently right now. But then in the Conjuring, it's just foreshadowing, you know, in advance and all that. So that's one difference that I can think of.
Yeah. There's more layers to the plot in Saw than there is in the Conjuring. And I think that's why in the Conjuring, we're mostly talking about the imagery and
the
purely cinematic qualities versus the story, because the story is pretty basic. And we already said it's, you know, it's using Christianity to repel evil and, you know, reinstating the family values, both with the Warrens and with the parents and everything. And, you know, everything goes back to the way it was. And that's what I mean. Like, we're not getting into the specifics of the story because it is so schematic and how it handles it.
Yeah, mechanics. There's a lot of cinematic techniques in that one for sure. The other one's more like on the plot wise. So that's just one difference.
Yeah, because I don't really think there's much interesting to say other than my criticism that the story of The Conjuring I find to just be very basic and not very interesting, which is why ultimately, though, I think The Conjuring is a better made movie than Saw. I find myself preferring Saw just because I find, even though I have problems with it as a film, I find the concepts and character stuff just a little more interesting and original.
Yeah, and the small little, I noticed that in the small little instances, you know, small little stunts, small little, you know, jump scares in Conjuring is very similar to, it's an Asian TV show where, it's a horror TV show where they ask a lot of people from worldwide to send them videos where they capture paranormal activities, right? So the small little instances such as, you know, the musical box showing the ghost and also the tree showing the woman hanging and even the hair, you know, when the spirit was pulling out one of the girl's hair and all that, and even the spirit, the evil ghost above the closet thing. I just think that small little instances are inspired from that because this was released in 2013, but what I watched is older than that. So I feel like these small little stunts is inspired by the Asian horror movie, you know, small little moments. Because remember that James Wan, he is Malaysian and Australian. So I think like he incorporated some Asian horror film conventions and applied it in The Conjuring and even in his other works.
Yeah, that's good because like you have would have more knowledge of that than I do.
You know, like in the Japanese horror movies, you always you know, like the fear is long-haired girl, long black-haired girl with this white jacket, you know, white nightgown thing. You know, like I feel like there is this association with that. You know what I mean? It's something that we can associate, especially with The Conjuring, because it's spiritual, you know what I mean? And in Asia, the idea of spirits and all that, there's this sense of fear. So that's why, like, it connects with more audiences in terms of Conjuring than it is for Saw, even though Saw has, like, interesting and extra layers of the plot and the script structure and whatsoever. That's just what I would say, especially from that perspective, the Eastern perspective.
Yeah, I guess we already talked about like why we think the film has resonated so popularly, in addition to like you brought up the points about the technology, and I think it's ultimately just a return to that sincerity of horror, of classical horror. And even though it's like been years since Scream and all the postmodern stuff came to be, but like I think for a long time classical horror movies, like the more sincere stuff was in the doldrums. And I think James Wan, even though he's relying on a lot of cliches, I think the fact that he did it with such sincere confidence in his form and ability to use them as tokens for his cinematic techniques, I think that's what helped this find an audience, especially to like a younger audience, right, who may not be so initially familiar with the more classical material that he's building from.
Yeah, I think that James Wan really successfully had like the world starting to love horror more, because especially in the pandemic with COVID-19 and all that, there's been more and more demand for like horror. And especially in my household and all that, we're constantly looking for, you know, horror movies to watch. You know, it's becoming an increasing demand, you know, but it doesn't but it won't change the fact that we're always going to have like the small fear, the classical fear, whether it's the fear of darkness, the fear of what's under your bed, the fear of, you know, the fear of blood, the fear of etc., you know.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize The Conjuring and James Wan, to be honest. Yeah,
so overall, what do you think? Do you think that more and more directors will pass on the James Wan legacy?
For sure. I mean, I think classical horror does endure for sure, and I think he's definitely reinstated it even after there were years of subversions, ironic winks in the horror genre. He was able to reinstate it, and I think if there ever comes a time in cycles where something moves away from that sincerity or that classical quality, it may be more underground. And if it infects the mainstream, it'll probably only be for a bit until the sincerity comes back, likely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what's your favorite scene in Saw, by the way? I never gotten to ask you about that.
I do kind of like the scene with Jigsaw and the detectives a little bit at the warehouse. And I also like the ending, just because it's has an epic, memorable feel, mostly due to the music.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Was that the part that scared you the most, though?
Didn't scare me, no. I think the part that made me...
Spooked?
No, I don't think Saw didn't really spook me. But, like, the thing that, like, was just, like, made me go cringe was just some of the traps, like the flammable safe scene, which parts of that made me cringe just thinking about being in a scene like that. While I also criticized, how the hell does he expect a guy to survive this?
Yeah, I really, the moment I kind of cringed myself was when Dr. Lawrence was confronting Adam. You know me, you secretly knew me, right? And then that's when the revelation happened. And I was like, what? You know, where did that come from? And then when the moment Adam reveals that it was the inspector who paid him, I was like, what? Where does that even come from? You know, I got a bit destabilized there, because then I started to be completely lost as the climax escalates. I was like, oh boy, I don't know where we're at anymore. There's been a lot of flashbacks and now this, like, what the fuck?
Yeah, with that note, I guess that I think we said all we can at the moment on Saw and The Conjuring. So.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Thanks for coming on, Koyuki. This was fun. Thanks for being a part of this. Fun,
yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So I guess I'll see. Maybe you'll be back in the future, but I'll see some back with somebody else probably next time. But again, thanks, Koyuki.
Thanks. See you, folks.